Before we get back to it, let's talk taxes. As many of you know, I recently took a 1099 private practice gig as an anesthesiologist after being a W-2 doc for 15 years. And honestly, after combining this with the business income from Money Meets Medicine, the tax piece almost broke me. Should I be an S-Corp? What about QBI deductions or the pass-through entity tax breaks I should be taking advantage of? Nobody really teaches this stuff in residency. You just kind of figure it out after you've already screwed it up. That's why I started working with Gelt for proactive tax planning for my own taxes. Gelt is a modern CPA firm that specializes in helping high-earning physicians. So whether you're a locums doc, a practice owner, a partner getting a K-1, or a W-2 physician with 1099 income on the side, Gelt handles the stuff that actually moves the needle. S-Corp elections, PTET credits, QBI, retirement optimization, really everything in between. The biggest reason I started working with Gelt myself is that unlike most CPA firms, they provide a proactive strategy all year long, not just an intake form and running the numbers in February or March each year. So if your CPA only reached out in February or March and left you wondering if you paid more on taxes than you should, it doesn't have to be that way. A great CPA is a year-round partner who knows your business and reaches out proactively. And Q2 is the best time to make a switch because Gelt specializes in exactly this kind of transition for those of you who are ready for a better experience. Speaking of which, when new clients get started this quarter, Gelt goes back through your last 3 years of returns and identifies deductions that were missed, and in some cases is able to recover them. This is included as a complimentary service for new clients. So if your tax situation has outgrown TurboTax or your current CPA only calls you in March each year, head over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA for a free consult with Gelt. And because you're a part of the Money Meets Medicine community, when you use that link, you'll also get a 10% discount off services with Gelt that first year as well. So head on over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA and check out Gelt. Would you believe me if I told you that the 90 days between finishing residency and cashing your first attending paycheck are some of the most financially consequential windows of your life? Keep listening as we dive in. Welcome to the Money Meets Medicine podcast, where we talk all about the personal finance topics you wish you learned in medical school. I'm your host, Dr. Jimmy Turner, and here's your co-host, who just got back from bringing his new Blackstone on a big camping trip, Justin Harvey.
Dr. Turner, great to see you. I was with family for the last 4 days in the wilds of Oregon with some other friends as well. It wasn't really camping. It was more like glamping. Yeah. At a cabin in the woods. We had a good time. Yeah, I'm at the state. You know, you get a few kids and it's like, do I really want to futz with all of that? Nah, I want a mattress and a little kitchenette. But I did bring the Blackstone. So we've talked about the big normal Blackstone. I got the 22-inch griddle for the tailgate, which is awesome. Just throw your 5-gallon propane in the back. And I got a propane splitter. So you get your little camp stove going over here with your two propane burners. You got your Blackstone going over here. So you get your griddle. And it is elite.
It's the way to glamp.
Highly recommend. We're not really roughing it too much.
That's peak glamping.
Yes.
As it were. Yeah, I'm a big fan of my Blackstone too, although I've had some very delicious meals on that. You know, I clearly need to go to the school of Blackstone to learn how to better care for my grill, as we've discussed offline. But I really do enjoy it and use it for a lot of stuff. We actually just smoked some steaks last night and I used it to kind of reverse sear it at the end. And it's a delicious meal every single time. That said, this show is not about Blackstones or griddles or camping. This is actually about that 6 to 12 months after you become an attending and some of the financial mistakes that doctors make. Because of something I've noticed over a decade of being an attending and doing the show is that window, like that first 12 to 24 months, really does set up your trajectory for your financial success. And so you can do some things wrong, but there's a lot of things that you need to do right, because some of them are really, really bad mistakes that actually limit you and make it very hard for you to find financial success later. And there are some things that, hey, like you can get to it later, not a big deal, right? So when your income jumps 8 to 10x overnight, you're also going to, in addition to having these financial tasks you need to take care of and consider, and maybe you don't even know about them, going to be approached by every single lender, realtor, car dealer in a 50-mile radius because you are a physician with money. And so you got this giant target on your back. And so today we want to walk through some specific financial things to consider as you become an attending. The show is getting launched in May. And so that's right before several of you are graduating residency or fellowship. And for those of you that are already attendings, maybe you can think back on some decisions that you've made. And I bet you'll still learn something by listening to the show and find some tasks maybe you need to take care of. Before we dive in, don't forget, as you are finishing residency or fellowship, listening to this show, make sure to get disability insurance. Before you do so, go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability. We'll look into all of your options, including the guaranteed standard issue policy that many residents have available to them. That is a very confusing topic, by the way, because it is offered to you as a resident at a program, but it is not offered by your program, which is why your program director and the head of the ACGME for your institution likely don't even know you have one. And so when you ask about these things, you get confused looks like you have seven heads, because it is an insurance offer made by a company to residents at specific programs. They likely have no idea that it is offered to you. So don't try to contact your HR. They're not going to know. Moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability. We do know. We can let you know what your options are. All right, let's dive in. So maybe let's talk about a couple of things that are top of mind. Naturally, the first one that jumps to immediate forethought, and may, before you graduate, this maybe the ship has sailed. You've already bought a house. You've already made big financial decisions that are going to cost you later. But I'm a big proponent of living in some moderation after you finish training. I fundamentally think you shouldn't live like a resident. I've talked about that recently on a show. You should enjoy some of that hard work you've created. But as I like to say, you can have anything when you finish training. You just can't have everything when you finish training and still retire by the age that you want, right? So you can go finance the car like I did. You can go get a luxury watch. You can go do a whole host of other things, but you can't get the luxury watch and the car and put your kids in private school and buy the $2 million home and then somehow expect to be able to retire at 60. Probably not going to happen. And so just be wise about the decisions you're making and the things that actually meaningfully move the needle for you. Maybe you're just a huge watch person and you just love the way that the dial looks and the way that the mechanisms in the watch are when you look at it and you got the self-wind the thing and it's got a 72-hour reserve. Like maybe that's you listening to the show and you just always wanted to get that one watch, that Omega, that Rolex, whatever it might be. I don't really care, right? I'm not here to tell you not to buy things. I'm here to tell you that if you do all of the things you want to do right when you finish, you put yourself in a situation, Justin, where it's my experience that once you really, really inflate your lifestyle, I know very, very, very few people that have been able to walk it back. Like once you start spending what you make, like somehow trying to carve out one of those things in your life that you added, private school for the kids, like, okay, we're going to go public school now and we're going to take that $40,000. We're going to invest it. I just don't know a lot of people that go that route. So much, much easier to tame it from the beginning than to try to reel it back in once you've started.
Absolutely. And I'll say, Jimmy, something else that I wouldn't say I've changed my mind about it, but I have sort of evolved the way I've thought about it in terms of just seeing a growing sample size of physicians that have sort of crossed the threshold into attendinghood and then seeing enough of their life to have they've been at it for 3, 5, 7 years. Starting taxable investments basically immediately, even if it's just $1,000 a month, even if you don't have your emergency fund all the way, but you know, like pay off high interest credit card debt for sure first, but
100%.
Start taxable investing earlier than you think you maybe would need to or want to. And ideally it's thousands per month, maybe 2, 3, 5, depending on how much your student loans are and some other moving parts. Like that is one of those things where when there's all this money in motion and you're not even really sure how much you're making yet, you got to like start looking at your checking account to see like how much did I even make last month? Because I haven't calibrated my expectations. When you're still in that zone, it's still wet cement. Things haven't solidified. Set up that taxable contribution. And by that, I mean an investment account that is not a retirement account. It's not inherently tax advantaged. There are tax implications. This is where tax loss harvesting happens. This is going to be broadly diversified, long-term money intended for the long future, but also accessible to you in the short term. It's kind of like an extension of your emergency fund for these purposes. But start that. Start it sooner rather than later. Start it before the end of the year when you commence attendinghood and just forget about it. Like set it and forget it. Get it automatically invested in some broad index. And this is the kind of thing that if it's $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 a month, I mean, that sounds like a lot because that's like your whole income when you're a resident, but as an attending, you're not going to notice $5,000 a month going out when you get a major pay raise and you turn around 12 months later and that's $60,000, $70,000, maybe $80,000 if it's a good market year in a brokerage account that you can do anything with. And that just tends to be a positive feedback loop. It's you're motivated once you see it happening. You're like, how do we increase it? And this is one of those activities that I do see distinguishes the clients who are really making pronounced progress. And it's not like they're scrimping by, they're just saving first. And they're standing head and shoulders above their peers in many cases after a few years.
Yeah, this is actually something that, as listeners know, I don't mind sharing my lessons that I learned too. This is something I wish I did. I did not do enough of this when I was starting out from training. We made massive headway in other ways. So I'm still a big proponent of what we did in terms of For us, we weren't doing public service loan forgiveness, which this is another topic of things to take care of in terms of tasks as a new attending. You got to create a student loan plan for the 70% of you that have student loans. But for us, student loan options were not the same back then. And so suffice it to say, I didn't make any payments during my training. We had $200,000 and we decided to pay that off. And that monthly payment that we had, then all of a sudden when it was gone, became what we used to pay for our house. And so that's when we moved into our houses once our student loans were gone. And that said, I do wish I'd started investing in a brokerage account well before I did, because I started just maximizing all my retirement space. And I even thought about it 4 or 5 years into my now 10 or 12 year journey that, hey, if we decided to hang it up early at 50, what accounts would we tap into, right? And so one solution, you'll actually find this funny, Justin. I meant to share this off air, but I'll share it on air. It's completely fine. I'm an open book. I did think about this problem. And one of the solutions that I came up with was, okay, well, my wife has access to a 457 because she's a state employee, as a teacher. I have access to a 457 where I work. And that is one of the very few accounts where you can actually tap into that in early retirement once you separate from your employer. Funny backstory here, because I know that there are several people from Wake Forest that listen to this show. So this will be educational for you, but also for others. When I went to leave Wake to take my new job, I taken this private practice job, but I reached out to them and said, hey, I'd still like to do the personal finance curriculum that I've taught for the last 6 years for the fourth year med students, if you would have me. I said, absolutely. Like, we're the only medical school in the country that does something to this extent. It makes us different. It's great for the students. We would love to continue to do that. Let's figure out a way to make that work. And their way to make it work was to kind of keep me part-time. So I was like, 0.1 FTE is a part-time faculty member. And in order to access your 457 money, you have to separate from your employer completely. So even being 0.1, they basically held my money hostage for like 6 weeks after I left. I've been gone for 6 weeks at this point. And I just called the retirement people and I was like, hey, so I am formally and officially released from employment there. When can I get my 457 money? And embarrassingly, I learned on this call that they have a 120-day waiting period before they will disperse that money to you. So I knew everything else about the 457, like what the options are. They had index funds. The distribution options were reasonable. That institution is now part of one of the fifth or sixth largest hospital systems in the country. So from a financial stability standpoint, like the three big questions were there and they were answered. But I didn't expect to change jobs when I did at this point in my career. And so they get to keep it for 4 months before I get it. But all that to say, tangent there. 457 money was one of the ways that I answered that question. But the brokerage account is obviously one of the more salient solutions to this problem if you want to tap into something before the age of 59 and a half. Now, I will push back and say, depending on how much money you save, taking the 10% hit on money you take out early from a pre-tax account, a 401k, a 403b, versus paying capital gains, depending on how that money is shuffled, is an interesting mathematical question to look at. And so that said, what you can't do inside of those retirement accounts that I didn't have as much appreciation for as you can in a brokerage account is the tax loss harvesting. It is the ability to take shares that have gained in value and then give those to a donor advised fund for your charitable giving efforts, where you can give the same amount of money to things you care about, but you're actually doing it in a way that saves you money from a tax standpoint and is actually less money from your pocketbook in order to accomplish the same amount of savings. So you can give more to people and to things that you care about by having a taxable brokerage account. And so it does provide a lot of benefits that I don't think when I was young in my career, I really had wrapped my head around, because all you hear is lower your tax burden, lower your tax burden, lower your tax burden. But then they don't really tell you that you can lower your tax burden through some of the mechanisms in a brokerage account.
Yeah. And interestingly, once you get to your brokerage account to certain levels, we've talked in the past about the separately managed account, also known as direct indexing, and there's some other names for it, depending on how you access this product. But if you replicate an index fund, essentially, in one account, but instead of buying an ETF, you buy all the component parts, all the 507 different securities in the S&P 500 or whatever it is. And in the last couple of years, we've seen this kind of approach, just because of the whenever there's a lot of volatility, having a separately managed account approach makes a ton of sense compared to an ETF because of the ability to tax loss harvest ongoing. And if you're putting money in every month, you're giving the manager an opportunity to continue to rebuy and rebuy and rebuy the securities. So that, you know, 2026 is a good example. So where we're at right now, it's April 21st, and I'm just going to do a quick look. The S&P 500, I think, is about flat year to date. I'll pull up a year to date chart. It's up 3%. But since March 30th, the last day of the quarter, it's up 12%. So in just a couple of weeks, it's up 12%. That means the first 3 months, it was way down. We actually saw an identical thing in 2025. You might remember the whole like tariff stuff where it was like the S&P was down 10% one day. And then Trump was like, hey, just kidding. That 100% tariff happening in China, not actually going to happen. And then the S&P is up another 12% the next day. And crazy volatility. If you hold the ETF, you're up like 2%. If you have the SMA, you're maybe up, you know, 1-3%, but you've also been like tax loss harvesting along the way, locking in these capital losses and allowing the manager to create that tax tailwind for you, which again, this is not a recommendation to buy any individual securities, but this is an idea to say, as you're building this taxable account bucket, one of the things you can do with it creates this capital loss carry forward to offset some of your ordinary income, to offset gains from real estate, to offset other capital gains from other investments in the future. And the sooner you get going on it, the better. I've seen this be a really fun and awesome tool.
If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the other shows over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Doctors Making a Difference. Be inspired by Dr. Peter Crane of Doctors Making a Difference. Discover stories of physicians who are transforming lives and communities. Celebrate the impact of medicine beyond the clinic. Listen and subscribe to be part of the movement.
Yeah, maybe to get really big picture for a second, maybe before we talk about like even accounts there, what we should say is that as you're finishing training, from a philosophical standpoint, you should be saving first and spending what's left. So the very first step in order would be to figure out how much do you need to be saving each year to be reliably assured you're going to be able to retire or reach financial independence. I don't even like using the word retirement anymore, because for me, more and more and more, this is about getting to a financial independence so that you can practice medicine on your terms, so that you can work the hours you want to work, take good care of people, stand up to administrators when you think that they're doing stupid things. Like for me, it's not really getting doctors to retirement. It is the ability to have you create enough financial freedom to allow you to live a life you want, which may still include, and I hope, continue to practice medicine. And so that said, you don't get there by accident. Like you need to figure out, okay, well, if I want to get to financial independence at age 45, let's do some math and figure out, okay, roughly speaking, this is about how much money I need to be saving every year. And naturally, the market could give you 10 to 15% returns. Like I think my portfolio the last 10 years has been up like 13 or 14% annually, and so which is
higher than historical norms, I will point out.
Yes. No, but my point being that because of that, right, like I could dial back some of my savings to some extent at this point because I got lucky when I entered the market. But you do need to figure out, okay, how much do I need to be saving to get to financial independence by the age that I want? And then how much money do I have left after that? Now we can talk about, okay, what are some other things you want to do? Like buy the house, buy the cars. You have to fit in your student loan payment and your disability insurance payment. And oh, by the way, don't forget to increase your disability insurance when you finish training, because you now need more coverage. That is something you need to do. And there are some insurance companies where if you don't actually do that and you say no, it goes away and you can't do it in the future. So don't ignore that email from your insurance agent about increasing your coverage. Like that is a big mistake depending on which insurance company you work with, but you got to fit the increased disability and coverage, the student loan payments, right? All that other stuff. And that has to happen after you've saved enough to get to financial independence by the age that you want. And also by doing that exercise, you might find out, okay, maybe I don't want to be financially independent at 42. Maybe 45 is more reasonable because I could save less money, or maybe 50 is more reasonable because I could save less money and live a little more right now. But you have to do the math.
Yeah. And if you're in an equilibrium in your work situation, like if you like your life, you don't need to get to financial independence yesterday. You establish a reasonable, replicable, low emotional tax system to get you where you want to go. And you just live your life and don't think about it.
Yep, for sure. And speaking of which, you also need to create a student loan plan. So you mentioned credit cards. Let's just talk about debt in general here. It is surprising to me that some studies that I've seen over the years have shown that like 20 to 25% of attending physicians have some form of recurring credit card debt or debt that's not paid off in full each month. And that is a spending problem. That is a financial literacy problem. If you find yourself in a situation when you finish training where you have recurring credit card debt, and yes, if you're listening to this, that is you and that's your situation, you need to get rid of your credit card debt. Like that is a financial emergency. You should not even have an emergency fund if you have $50,000 in 25% APR credit card debt. You should be paying that off with whatever you have because you're not getting 25% returns anywhere else in your life other than with a 401k or 403b match. And so debt plans also fit into this, and student loan plans in particular, because I see a lot of people make mistakes around this period when they haven't really thought through and run the numbers and gotten a student loan consult and figured out, hey, should I be doing public service loan forgiveness? Like, what plan should I be in? Like, the repayment assistance plan's coming out in July, and that works completely different than income-based repayment. Depending on when your loans were out, pay as you earn is still an option as well. And so you need to think thoughtfully through what you're going to do, because some of those plans require a partial financial hardship, which when you become an attending, you may no longer have. And so it is important to consider, what is my plan going to be, and run through those numbers with somebody to figure it out if you need to, if it's not a simple situation. Some of you are going to be in really obvious situations where you're not working for a 501c3, you're not working for the VA, you're not working for a state hospital. You've got $100,000 student loans and you're a plastic surgeon making $600,000 a year. You're just going to pay it off. Like, just refinance your loans, get the lowest interest rate you can and pay it off. Like, you don't need to pay somebody to help you figure that out. That's a very simple situation, right? But for a lot of you, it's not going to be simple. You're going to be married. Maybe you're in a community property state. Maybe you're not. Maybe your spouse has loans. Maybe they don't. It gets really complicated very quickly. And so if that fits your scenario, you can go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/loans and actually get a $100 discount off working with Student Loan Planner, who's our student loan partner. But yeah, I see a lot of mistakes with this one, and it gets kind of swept under the rug.
Especially for physicians transitioning to attendinghood. This may seem obvious to some people, but I'm just going to say it because it's an easy mistake to not make if you know. Don't carry a credit card balance because it's going to make your credit score better.
Oh boy, yeah.
And I have been, you know, a little surprised, but I've seen it enough now that it's just a thing that people think, like, oh, I should make sure I have some money on a couple different credit cards and that it's rolling over each month to keep my credit score as high as possible. Don't do that. You're paying a lot of money. Pay off all your credit in full every month if you have the cash to do it. The amount that you're carrying each month is not going to be something that's going to help your credit score compared to total credit capacity and the total balance, meaning like you want the balance to be as close to zero, like unutilized balance across all your credit lines. That's how you want to improve your credit score, not by carrying a balance.
If it's any case study example, my wife and I have paid off all of our credit cards forever for as long as we've been married, and both of our credit scores are above 800 without carrying any balance at all. But we have lots of credit available to us. And so by having that very large credit balance and not using as much of it as we could and paying it off every month, we've been able to get very strong credit scores. That's interesting. That's almost like when people have the misunderstanding about like doing a backdoor Roth IRA, which is something else we should mention on this one, which is they put it into the account and then it's in the settlement fund and they never actually invest it. Mm-hmm. They think like, oh, I'm participating in this. Same thing happens in HSAs where the money is in the account, but it's not actually invested. And then 10 years later, you realize you've actually been losing money to inflation. It has never been invested. Like, don't let that be you. You do actually have to invest the money in the account, not just put money into the account. Which reminds me, this is actually something else on the checklist. And at this point of the year, April, this may be too late for some of you that are just, you know, personal finance aficionados and you love doing your Roth IRA contributions like January of every year. Because I definitely run into residents who've just like gotten the personal finance bug, like they got bit by it and they just fill up the IRA every single year, Roth IRA, because I'm a resident, R is for R. And they are just so passionate about it, right? And then I have to
break that one.
Yeah, Roth is for resident. Unless you have student loans, and then pre-tax contributions actually lower your student loan payment, but that's a different conversation. But where they run into this problem here is the attending transitionhood to becoming an attending. And oh, by the way, for many of you, maybe the year where you go above the limit where you can now no longer directly contribute to a Roth IRA and you have to do your first backdoor Roth IRA. So save up the money and contribute it through the back door if that's what you're going to do. Justin and I have had conversations on the show about our thoughts on backdoor Roths versus taxable brokerage accounts, and maybe comes out in the wash on that one. But if that is your flavor and you plan on filling up that account, this is the first year in your last year in residency or fellowship before becoming an attending. That becomes a question. And speaking of which, I did an Instagram post the other day, and I need to apologize for all my pediatrician friends because I had a few of you call me out on the post that when I made the comment that this is the first year you're going to make more than you can to contribute directly to a Roth IRA. And they're like, not some of us. I was like, I am.
Wow.
That is touche. That is fair.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm a terrible human being. Forgive me for not considering all of the fine physician friends that we have in the medical community. Because for some of you, it will take the next year when you have your full attending salary for the entire year before you hit that limit.
I remember talking to a pediatric nephrologist. I think it was like $140 or $150 they were making. I was helping them with a student loan plan. And just thinking about all the school and all the work and how much smarter this person was than me. And I couldn't believe it. So it is humbling to consider when you're somebody that needs those people. I'm so grateful that those people exist. I, as a father, have benefited from pediatric subspecialists And I'll just take a moment and say, like, thank you for not necessarily getting on the nothing against the road to happiness. Hey, my wife is on the road. Shout out to the road. But for people who are a little more money agnostic and who are driven by a spirit of inquiry and wanting to serve a specific patient population and a certain intellectual curiosity, like, thanks for being out there. And we're better. And I'm appreciative for your journey.
100%. Couldn't say it better myself. And I'm married to a teacher, so we have a lot of similar feelings about education in our household. But yeah, that's something to consider for the higher paying specialties, is that this may be the first year you need to do a backdoor Roth. If that's not you, keep doing the Roth. Completely cool. Nothing wrong with it. But you don't want to have to recharacterize your contributions and fill out the 8606 and get a CPA.
So annoying.
It is. Because people are like, oh, it's not that big a deal. I'm like, yeah, but it's annoying when you don't have to do that if you knew that you just needed to do the backdoor Roth instead. But if you did contribute, yes, you're going to have to recharacterize stuff. And it's just another thing to add to the list of things to do.
I had an advisor friend observe to me that if you're doing a backdoor Roth and you're going to hire a CPA to do your taxes for $700, just because you can't do the 8606 on TurboTax, which is very difficult. And I don't know if it's easier now. I was trying to help a client do it the other day and we couldn't on TaxAct or TaxSlayer or one of those like freebie or discount services. It's like, yeah, you got to talk to a CPA. We'll extend it. And like, you've definitely, we can split hairs about what is the actual economic benefit of doing the backdoor Roth compared to taxable. But almost certainly, if you're paying somebody between $500 and $1,000 to prepare your taxes just because you did the backdoor Roth, you have probably consumed more than the total economic benefit of actually doing that. And you should have probably just put it in a taxable account and called it good and done your own taxes. I mean, you should never do your own taxes once you're an attending, but it's an interesting thought exercise to say the margins are so thin for that. If you need to bring in an expert and pay smart people to like do the technical stuff, do we really need that? I don't know.
I couldn't agree more. And listeners know that I don't do backdoor Roth IRAs anymore myself. So
I mean, don't get me wrong. You should hire an advisor and you should hire a CPA. So maybe that's all that needs to be said on the topic.
Yep. Yep. And I'm a fan of both of those services for sure. But make sure that you are just thinking through what the transition is going to look like, the implications that it has making an attending paycheck the second 6 months of the year, because there are some as you think through this. And maybe one last call out as you're making this transition is just to be a little bit of a miniature expert on the benefits that your new job provides, whether that be the 401k or the 403b, 457, the HSA, whether they cover your malpractice insurance or not, and the tail if you leave. You need to become a little bit of an expert on those things, because there are opportunities to save money, save taxes, invest prudently through those accounts. And probably one of the examples I could give you of why this might be important is most of these things have vesting schedules. And so that is, how long do you need to stay somewhere before you get to keep the matching money that they give you? So great. You put $50,000 in over a 2 year and 10 month period, and they put $50,000 in to match your money. Well, guess what? If you leave before 36 months or 3 years, you don't get to keep it, right? And you just signed a new job because something in your family came up. You'd probably want to know that and stay for an extra 2 months to maybe get your 50 grand. It might be worth it for that situation. So there's little details like that. I think it's helpful to understand when looking through the benefits that are provided at your employer. And when I was at Wake, I got asked and got to answer the question about HSAs every single year by like dozens of people about whether they should do it or not. So constantly a conversation. So as we round out the show, those are some things to think about as you're making the transition to becoming an attending. Maybe some things that you may have wanted to think about if you already are an attending, to get your mind thinking through the possibilities and the considerations for taxes and investing and student loans and a whole host of other things. But as you head out, please make sure to go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability to get disability insurance. If you are a resident or fellow leaving training, or if you are someone who knows someone that is, please pass along the link. It's super important to take care of that before they head out. As always, we'll see you next week. Cheers. Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he helps anesthesiologists and pain medicine physicians. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing academic anesthesiologist at Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's also a licensed insurance agent. However, either Justin or Jimmy are your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should be considered financial advice. All views expressed are solely the views of the guests on the show and do not represent the views or opinions of their employer.